Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. I'm going to say your name wrong again. It's been too long. We haven't talked in months, man. It's nice to see you again. You're keeping alive during the winter. Glad, Gary, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it. Yeah, the winter hasn't been a winter like it hasn't been in a lot of places. We've had barely 9 inches of snow, and it's pretty much gone. We had an inch in November. That left. I went to Jacksonville on the 15th, the night before. We got 7 inches, and that's it. I get home, and it's gone. And so it's never happened before, literally. I've been through 76 Minnesota winters. So I'm like the Eskimo that has 55 words for snow. So I know the patterns. And this has never happened. And it's, you know, we could still get dumped on in March. We get snow in April.
It had to be November the last time we talked, because I think I had you on for a bunch of episodes leading up to the 60th anniversary, which was actually a subject I wanted to talk to you about, which was, are you still surprised that there's still new information and stuff coming out 60 years later?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's got to be related to the fact that photography was not in full swing, but it had developed to the point where thousands of pictures were taken. And of course, a Zapruder film. And so, you know, if you can see an event, it's a lot different than Lincoln's assassination, where people still research that, but they don't have pictures and as many documents to go on. So I swear that as 10,000 people retire every day in the United States, 3 million a year from the baby boomers, that's 10,000 people that have been too busy to think about the Kennedy assassination. And now 60 years later, they've got time on their hands, and a percentage of them are going to dig, read books, et cetera, et cetera. And it's almost like that's going to scare up somebody that has real direct information about what happened 60 years ago. You know, logically, it just seems like that could be the case.
You mentioned that you had some new research that you were working on. I didn't really have a pre-plan of what we were going to end up talking about. I was going to ask you a little bit about some information on New Orleans, but I'm interested in what new research you were able to come across.
Well, like I said, I presented at a history conference in South Dakota, where my wife is from Sioux Falls, so I get there quite often. So it was easy to give them a proposal, and the theme was crime on the Great Plains. And it was a 55th annual history conference that their Center for the Study of Western History is located. And so I told them I wanted to talk about JFK. Other people, of course, would talk about Jesse James, who spent time in Minnesota, Great Northfield, Minnesota bank raid, just south of the Twin Cities back in, what, 1876 or 70? I forget now, but anyway, it's still a big deal in Northfield, Minnesota to have that historic attraction. So anyway, I proposed that I talk about a crime that I thought was going to happen in North Dakota in 1960. And September 25th, when I went through those open doors unimpeded. And so I'll allude to that a little more today, because what happened at the conference in Sioux Falls was a little strange, because there this guy is still alive. He's 90. He was a professor at the University of North Dakota till he was 87. 3 years ago, and the guy is still sharp as a tack. He presented a few hours before I did. And I went into his presentation to honestly watch what he was going to say about, well, I didn't know. It wasn't really about crime as much as it was his own history in and around Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where his parents homesteaded. And I said to him, I'll stay for your presentation if you stay for mine, or if you come and see me this afternoon. And he said, well, I've got a former student who has an intern who's presenting, so I'm going to have to go to that during your presentation. And that was that. Now, this professor had been told to be a CIA asset as of 1962. And I was told that by another professor. And I had both of them as teachers back in the late 60s at UND. So I was told by his colleague that when the two of them finished their PhDs at the University of Oklahoma, which, by the way, is apparently a hotspot for the CIA to recruit, the colleague said, the CIA recruited us. I turned them down, but he didn't. And they both proceeded shortly thereafter to head for the University of North Dakota, an Air Force base, a nuclear base. I suppose that's a place to place CIA assets just to monitor the public, et cetera. And so I've known this. And here in our bios in the program for the conference, I was identified, you know, I'm talking about JFK. And when I accidentally breached security at his speech in September 25th, 63. And, you know, I see him presenting. So I do my presentation, and I notice in the back of the room, there's a woman, University of North Dakota professor, had presented that morning, and I'd been at her presentation. So I was glad to see her there. And I finished at about 12:30, I think, and attended another presentation at 1 o'clock. And at 3 o'clock, they had a break. And I walked into the atrium of this Western Studies Center, and the two of them were sitting there. Of course, they knew each other as UND professors. And I stood in front of them, and I said, Dr. So-and-so, were you at Kennedy's speech on September 25th, 1963? And she volunteered. Well, he wasn't there in 63. And I said, well, yeah, he got there in 1962. Well, it was right in the brochure for the conference. And I had read it and was reminded that he got there as a 30-year-old, ostensibly as a CIA asset, proceeded to teach for going on 50 years, I guess, Western Civ, which I took from him, and other history courses. But it was strange that she ran interference for him. And I, at that moment, I just said, well, yes, you were there. You got there in 62. And I don't think my tone was even that aggressive. I just said 62. And I said, so were you there? And he mumbled so that I couldn't make out an answer. I mean, it was obvious that he was trying to avoid admitting he was at Kennedy's speech. And if he said no, how could you not, with JFK across the street from your academic building?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be using sicker vacation days to make it to that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a history prof. He's a, that doesn't fly. So then he said something strange. He said, because in my talk, I had talked about a deceased professor of debate and speech at the University of North Dakota, who was in charge of security that day. He was not in charge, but he was a liaison between the White House and the university. And see, so he set up student security systems and so on, just to take advantage of the fact that you could have students there with eyes watching, whatever. And his name was Dr. John Penn, who I've talked about in this before, I believe. And the anonymous doctor here, the CIA set, says, well, John and I, Dr. Penn, and I became very close in 2003 when his son committed suicide. Well, I vaguely remembered that because I grew up in the same neighborhood. And why would he be telling me that he grew very close? I mean, I can see why somebody would grow close if they had a friend whose son committed suicide, obviously. And they were both professors. They apparently knew each other. But what he's saying is, because 2003, when Dr. Penn's son committed suicide, is when I was interviewing him about why I was able to walk through those doors with my friend. So, you know how you something doesn't register at first, and the more you think about it, the more it makes sense. And so the takeaway is that he's telling me that Dr. Penn, being very close to him in 2003, told me that an ex-student was snooping around about the Kennedy assassination. So he's known about me since 2003, even if he didn't remember me as a former student. Now I'm not just a former student, I'm some kind of gumshoe or investigator trying to, amateur sleuth, trying to make sense out of how I got through those doors. I mean, it's not a stretch for one to say that he was telling me something. I didn't quite know what. Well, that was the end of that. The break at 3 o'clock ended, and we went our separate ways to further meetings that day at the history conference. So since April 23rd, I've been beating my brains out trying to figure out how to contact him, short of going 300 miles to North Dakota, where the university is. And he lives in my family's neighborhood. My family still lives in the same house, a few blocks from where this CIA set, ostensible CIA set, lives. So I can get to him. I could call him and ask him to elaborate on what he meant when he said that he had become very close. Number one, that means she had reported to him what I said about him in the speech after his speech. And so a few weeks ago, I called the sister of the friend that I walked through those doors with. And I called her because he passed away about 2 years ago now. I'm 76, so he was 74 at the time. And when I'd go to conferences in Dallas, he'd drive in from Wichita Falls and we'd hang out. And so I hadn't lost track of him, and we'd talk about going through those doors that day in 63. And his dad was the one that said to me in about 1967, we're sitting in his backyard that abutted my mother's house, and he says, Gary, what's it all about? And I had no idea what he was talking about. His next sentence was JFK or LBJ did it. And at the time, I could only figure that he thought, since my dad had died in 65 and we had seven kids, I was the oldest, that he thought maybe I had figured out something about the meaning of life, right? And I hadn't. I was still bouncing off the walls trying to figure out how I had got six kids overnight. My brothers and sisters were from 3 months to 13 years old, and I was 18. So it was kind of a shock to my system. My dad died the day I started college, within a few blocks of where Kennedy gave his speech. So anyway, I called her. Bruce is my friend that went through the doors with me. I called her out in southern Vermont, where she's been for years. I haven't had a lot of contact with her, but I just wanted to touch base again about her brother, my friend. And I told her the story about Dr. Penn, deceased Dr. Penn. And she said, oddly enough, "I hope you have this documented." I said, "Well, yeah, it's documented in various Zooms and podcasts and so on." She said, "No, I mean documented." I didn't quite get that. I mean, like a certified statement or something I should have put together. And she says, "Well, you know, that was a threat. He was telling you he knew about you and your research since 2003 when Dr. Penn became involved with your interviews." I remember I interviewed this Dr. Penn like 3-4 times, and the fourth time he didn't expect me to come back a second, third, and fourth time, but I called him up every time I got to town to visit my mother in North Dakota, going from the cities, Twin Cities. And so the fourth time, he says, "This time, instead of the hotel, let's meet at my apartment." So I go to the apartment, knock on the door. He opens it up. There's two dining room chairs snug up against the door frame. He immediately says, "Sit down." I sit. The dining room chairs shouldn't have been by that position. They should have been in the dining room. They were obviously dining room chairs. He sits down, leans over, looks in my face, and says, "You don't think I was involved, do you?" And I think I told that anecdote in a previous interview. But the chance comment by my friend's sister saying that was a threat, you need to have that documented so that if something happens, somebody knows where the threat might have come from. Now, you know, a lot of people would simply dismiss that as paranoia and whatever. But there's too much context there and too much circumstantial evidence to just dismiss it. So,
could I ask your opinion if you think that there was a number of people that were contacted by the CIA that might have had some connections on college campuses, wondering if there was any scholars or young students looking to explore these avenues that came to the research or understanding of the JFK assassination? I mean, we know about Gary Schoner's experience when he was teaching at a, if I'm not mistaken, at a campus, or he was there where someone had went through their desks and envelopes and things of that sort, looking for, obviously he was teaching a class or teaching something about the JFK stuff. And he explained that experience when he was on here. And we know about the massive amount of people's stories that come out of the National Archives. Like, I'm not super conspiracy in that area. I think there's probably a lot of people that just end up doing something as a sign of patriotism. But you've had so many weird, like, kind of coincidences that it would be really hard to try and explain those away without trying to think of the possibility that there was people that were trying to figure out what other people were looking into when it came to the JFK assassination. Because in the beginning, anybody that would even hear the murmur of researching the JFK assassination, you were labeled or the government made a file about you. We have a list of first generation and second generation researchers that have files in the National Archives of just tabs on them. Person requested for this file. And they're still waiting for those files 50, 40 something years later.
Oh yeah. I, without a doubt, to answer your question, there are lots of people that function as assets, CIA assets. not agents, but assets. Some are agents, I guess. But yeah, in my own case, and I'll say more about Gary Schoner because he's part of one of the new developments. He just lives across town from me, and so we easily stay in touch. But I mean, I was recruited as an informer by the Grand Forks, North Dakota police. I went to them, to the captain's office, and I asked, I'm doing an informational interview for a sociology class. And this is before I was in the anti-war movement, starting in about 68 or 9. And I'd been a Division I hockey player with North Dakota. So I was this all-American type, you know. Now, I wasn't an all-American, don't get me wrong, but I guess he thought I looked the part that would be able to infiltrate student organizations. And I couldn't believe he was asking me to be an informer. Now, who asked him to ask me to become an informer? I have no idea, but I just ignored him and went on with the informational interview about what it's like to be a police chief and a cop. Never saw him again. But I thought that was really strange, that that means they recruited others on campus. And remember, it was a nuclear base with a university. There was plenty of reason to have eyes and ears there. And I mean, I had next door neighbors that were launch officers for Minuteman Missile. And so I had lots of experiences with people involved in nuclear war. And I had assumed that he was asking me to be an informer concerning the anti-war movement on campus. I had refused induction in 1970, just after he asked me to be an informer. I was on my way moving politically left just after he asked me to be an informer. Well, that made me a suspect in the eyes of the FBI. I was living on the edge of campus, just two blocks from my mother's house, while I was going to school to finish my degree. And Nixon was coming to town to do a campaign stop for a North Dakota senator. And he was only stopping at the airbase or the airport. They're two different places. And I wasn't even going to go see him. You know, I didn't like him, but I was going to head for a class one morning. And I walk out, and I'm in a rooming house. I walk out the door, got to go down a few steps, and I look up, and here's an unmarked car sitting barely 75 feet from the door I'm going out. And the guy's looking at me. And I did an about face, went back in and told a roommate. And we observed them then through the windows on the main floor of the house. And the next day, or even 3 days later, I came out and I looked to my right, and now the same car was a half a block away, sitting next to my wife's sorority house, in fact, which was catty corner from my rooming house. And this time I didn't go back in the house. I just kept walking to class. But these two experiences were 4 days apart. 2 days before Nixon got there, 2 days after he left. Well, I found out through the grapevine. Now, I'd been in quite a few actions on campus on the day after, or the night and the day after Kent State happened. And the campus cop, who I vaguely knew, frequented a bar where my uncle was a bartender. And the campus cop told my uncle that they were watching me because they thought I was capable of taking a shot at Nixon. God, I couldn't believe it. You know, I've asked for a file at, an FBI file. Never saw it.
Who and when were you approached about being an informant?
Well, it was 19, had to be 68. It was the chief of police in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I just went in, announced myself. Could I do an interview with you about police work? And halfway through my attempt to interview him is when he said, you know, I think you'd be a good informer. I think you could help us. You know, and it was the Vietnam War, and nobody can imagine that a campus in North Dakota would be active, but it really was. And they could see me. You know, I had some visibility being an ex-North Dakota hockey player. Well, at that time, I was still playing. And you know, it's just like when I refused induction 75 miles south of Grand Forks in Fargo, which everybody's heard of Fargo, right? The movie, et cetera. So I go there, and I burned my draft card the week before in front of my draft board. And so I was actually in Chicago. In between getting my first draft notice, I went to Chicago. I was working for an ambulance crew, and I slipped an old hockey injury disc. Now we're up to 19, early 70 when that happened. And I had to quit the ambulance crew, and I went back to Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I got a second draft notice. I went to Fargo to the induction center. It was a really 20 below zero, icy day. And I had to walk from the bus depot to the induction center. And they took me into a room with the other inductees. And I'm sitting there, and a couple officers come in, and they say, come with us, because I've made it clear that I'm going to refuse induction. And it's already hit the newspapers, and television cameras are outside. You know, you're a North Dakota hockey player. You got some notoriety, and you're not supposed to be doing things that smack of anti-war action. It makes a story. So as I stood up to go with these other officers, they didn't want me to contaminate the other 100 guys in the room with my ideas. But I stood up and I said, guys, you know, we were taught as we grew up the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Now, maybe that was a little bit over the top, but, you know, that's what I was feeling at the moment. I'm 21 years old, still wet behind the ears. And you could hear a pin drop. One lone voice in the back of the room that 100 of us were sitting in waiting to be inducted said, good luck, man. Nobody jeered me or told me to F off. So I went into the next room, and they tried to swear me in, and I refused to step forward, and so I'm arrested. Now, remember, my disc had slipped, and I went numb from the waist down. Never happened before. But I'd walked a few blocks from the bus depot to the induction center and aggravated it. And the inductions people said, do you want some morphine? I said, yeah, this has never happened. I better. Well, it knocked out the pain, but they took me in a staff car to the local hospital a few blocks away. And this brain surgeon, a neurosurgeon, was told to come and check me out. He came in the room. He said, "Where'd you go to school?" "UND." "What'd you major in?" "History." "Get out of here before I get a shrink down here." And I said, I swore at him and I said, you know, "You're full of BS. This is a real injury. It's not psychosomatic like you are implying." Went back to the induction center. Now the morphine's wearing off and I'm doubled up in the back seat of the staff car again. I go back into the induction center and the line is formed heading for another physical inspection. And the president of my fraternity is standing by the door of the captain and his induction center. And my fraternity brother says, "I was standing here when you were taken to the hospital, and he called the hospital and told the doctor to make sure they don't find out anything wrong with you." So I walked into the captain's desk. He says, "Get ready. You're going to Fort Lewis, basic training in Washington." I said, "I'm not going anyplace." He says, "Well, be back here with doctor's statements about your slip disc." Not a bone spur, a slip disc. And I went back to UND. I talked to a psychiatrist that I knew just from a distance. And he said, "No." He says, "If we tell them it's not psychosomatic, they have such a hard time knowing what that even is, it'll just confuse them. So we'll just tell them you got this real disc injury and leave it at that." Well, I went back a week later and I was declared 4F, which for you young guys, it's a category that is means you're physically unable to go through basic training. And so that was the end of it. But the FBI had arrested me. Must have been after Kent State.
They made it impossible for you to just say, "I don't want to get drafted."
Yeah. Yeah, they tried to induct me a second time. And in between, the FBI shows up. I was living in a fraternity house across the street from where I had been living in this rooming house for the summer. My mother calls me and says, "The FBI was just here. They need to talk to you. They're coming over." Well, I was two blocks away. So they knock on they come to the front door of the fraternity house, and there's just a few of us living there that summer. Got to the door and I said, "Can I go upstairs and get a jacket?" "No, you can't." Well, they thought I was going to go out the fire escape. I'm sure they never lose their man, right? So they took me to the jail and never inside the cell, but they were booking me. I was released on my own recognizance by the federal judge. And then, strangely enough, a month later, they dropped the charges. They didn't want any more visibility for me. In other words, I could have affected more draftees. And that was the end of that. But the judge was the guy named Judge Davies, Ronald Davies, was the guy that gave the order to integrate Little Rock Central High School in 1954. I think it was 54. Eisenhower had appointed him to order Governor Faubus of Arkansas, I think it was Faubus, to integrate that high school or junior high, I forget which. So he now is the federal building in North Dakota in Grand Forks is named after him. So I suppose his liberal attitude had something to do with releasing me and my own recognizance, right? And, you know, I'm sure at that point a file started, but I continued to be involved in the anti-war movement. I went to a seminary in Connecticut for a year, and I think I got arrested at a Sikorsky helicopter plant outside Hartford one Saturday. And so, you know, you just assume you've got a file.
Were you surprised at the number of measures that they would do just to try and get you to go to basic training?
Yeah, because again, I mean, if
there is a large amount of sentiment about the number of people that were in support of going to Vietnam to fight for their country, based on all the most of the Vietnam movies we have, is that sentiment. But it turns out that a lot of people didn't care what was going on there. It wasn't until like the Pentagon Papers and stuff like that that people really started being like, "What the hell are we doing?" I mean, I think a little bit before that, people were questioning. But most of the time, it was kind of like it was just going on and people were going about their lives a little bit, from what I've understood. But you realize that there actually was some dissent amongst going to, I guess, at least maybe amongst the youth. But, you know, every movie you watch about the Vietnam War is all about how we had to go over there and take care of this threat. And you realize it wasn't like that at all. I mean, especially as a history teacher, you kind of realize that, holy shit, like there's a different side of history we're really not teaching.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It at some point it, I suppose you could say, became more normalized to not resist. There were enough of us resisting so that it was important to the powers that be to neutralize some of us. And I chose not to go to Canada. I mean, I had six brothers and sisters that I had to take care of. You know, I couldn't leave my mother in the lurch. In fact, I left the seminary in Connecticut after a year because I just couldn't bear leaving her with six kids trying to deal with it with no money. There was no life insurance involved. And so that kind of derailed my desire to get a PhD in philosophy and religion so I could teach it. But yeah, I was surprised, but yet again, because, you know, there was Muhammad Ali. I think he had an influence on me to motivate me to refuse induction.
Yeah, and he gave up a large part of his life just because he didn't believe in what was going on.
Yep. And yeah, they took away a lot of, took away his gold medal, I think, from the Olympics.
Took away his golden years is what they did.
Yeah, yeah. But I lost aunts and uncles who, you know, were basically conservatives, and they couldn't understand why, you know, and it, well, I'll show you something here. If we segue into another development, I got a call on about November 18th, I think, from the Fargo Forum, which is a pretty healthy newspaper considering how bad off so many of them are. They own about 15 daily newspapers in Minnesota, South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota. They're called the Fargo Forum. And here it is. And I get a call. You can see here it's
JFK,
a front page
on the front
story. Front page story on JFK visiting Grand Forks the day that I was there, September 25th. 60 years later, they wanted to do a story for November 22nd. So this reporter calls me and says, just doing our research, we discovered your research. And can we talk to you? So I was on the phone with them for 2 hours, and they did this, and they had to have it done. The reporter says, I can only do 1,000 words. So, you know, whether we talk for 2 hours or an hour, I'm not going to be able to put it all in. But then when it appeared, it says continued on page 9. And on page 9, it was turned into a a full page with pictures of Kennedy and letting me talk a lot about my research. And she told me, the reporter then tells me, we decided to make it a feature story and put it behind a paywall to generate some subs. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, 60 years later, they were revisiting some of my research that was about Oswald being in North Dakota in 1954 and 1956 as a 15, 16-year-old or so.
Wait a minute. Oswald?
Yeah.
We've never talked about that.
No.
Why now? Why now are you just waiting to tell me?
I don't know. Just been too much other things to talk about, I guess. And it was a little more difficult to articulate how that happened. But
first off, do we know it was Oswald?
Well, we don't. And we don't because when I told Peter Dale Scott back in, when I was doing the research in 1999, another North Dakota professor and I made him aware of John Armstrong's discovery that one of the two Oswalds was in North Dakota the summer of 54. I was in a magazine, I was in a big store in Minneapolis, every magazine you could imagine, in about 1998. And here was a magazine called Dallas Monthly. And on the cover was Mrs. Connolly. And she was dressed in black. And the caption was, "The death of JFK, do we still care?" So they'd interview people like her to talk about whether we still care. And in 2000, of course, what is that? 27 years, 25 years after the assassination. So it's still being researched big time.
In 2000?
Well, this is 1998, I'd say.
Okay. Well, that would be way more than that. That'd be 30-something years. 38, 37 years? Yeah.
73, 83, 93, 40 years.
Almost 40.
Yeah. So I buy the magazine. I read it standing there in the space in the shop. Take the magazine, and I notice that in the article, it's white letters on black background, just for effect, I guess. And it's quite a few pages long. And in there, it quotes John Armstrong of Harvey and Lee fame. You know who I'm talking about, right? Saying that Oswald showed up in Stanley, North Dakota in 1954. And I thought, what the hell? So I call up Armstrong. And he says, well, why don't you go there and see what you can find out? You're there. I'm not. So I'm at a conference on Kennedy, on the assassination at the University of Minnesota in 99. And I meet another professor from North Dakota who I never knew existed. He had been at University of North Dakota since 66, 3 years after the assassination. He had been recruited by the CIA when he was at a branch of the University of Colorado at Pueblo. And then he got he's two PhDs, one in statistics and one in research methods. And, you know, he had the credentials to look at something scientifically. So here we meet at this conference. He didn't know about it. We were at the same conference at the University of Minnesota. And Armstrong was there speaking. But I told this other professor, who's also in this article in the Fargo Forum, about the Armstrong research and Harvey and Lee. And we agreed to go there. It's about 250 miles west in the middle of the oil patch in North Dakota. More oil than the only place that is more oil is the Permian Basin in Texas, I think. And anyway, we go there and we start interviewing people because a woman wrote LBJ a letter on December, well, just after the assassination, still in November. And she said, my son played with a kid that looks and fits the description of Lee Harvey Oswald back in 1954. They were playmates for the summer. So we're finding, well, the FBI shows up in North Dakota, in Stanley, North Dakota, on December 23rd, 1963, 2 weeks after the assassination, or what is that, a month after. And so we know who they interviewed. And John Armstrong gave me top secret documents that he had somehow come across, National Archives or otherwise. And so we start digging. We go to the County Historical Society, and we find out that the town was full of Finnish immigrants who were communists. Now, a lot of radical Finns went to northern Minnesota back in the teens because it was a mining area. And apparently some went further west a few hundred miles around Stanley, North Dakota, which is about 50 miles southwest of Minot, which more people have heard of. There's a nuclear base there to Minuteman missiles. And the county archivist says, well, you need to talk to a guy named Lyle Aho, A-H-O. He's passed away now. So we find him. We show him pictures of Oswald. He says, that's kind of looks like the guy that I played with that summer. And we showed him his adult photos, and he didn't know who it was. Even when we said it was Lee Harvey Oswald, he said, who? So he was really out of the loop in terms of paying attention to the news. But of course, it was only 2 weeks after the, or a month after the assassination, that he was interviewed by the FBI, and they went away, and he didn't pay any attention after that, apparently. Then we go to the state's attorney, a 90-year-old attorney who was still running the show for law enforcement in Mountrail County, where Stanley was. And I held up a top secret document about them, the FBI interviewing the mayor of Stanley, North Dakota, who I guess had passed by then. And so here we are asking this county attorney if he can say something about this interview the FBI had with the mayor. Well, he just played dumb. I don't know what you're talking about. He maybe thought we were FBI. I don't know. But he wouldn't talk. And how can you be the county attorney and the mayor's office is right next to your office and you didn't know the FBI came to Stanley, North Dakota? I said that to him. You don't remember the FBI being here on December 23rd? Nope. Now, again, clearly trying to hide something or didn't want to open a can of worms because he knew. This is also a hotbed of the John Birch Society. Now, the plot thickens because my next door neighbor was the state petroleum engineer. My buddy that went through the door with me was his son. His daughter was the woman that told me 3 weeks ago you were being threatened by the CIA asset who was a professor at the University of North Dakota. So this is all kind of coming together, and so we couldn't get to the mayor. Like I say, he was either moved away or had passed away. But Armstrong and subsequently I did too, we got in touch with the 13, 14 year old kid who was now in his 60s living in Bullhead City, Arizona, functioning as a, or working as a barber. And his mother was also there, the one that wrote LBJ the letter. So I talked to them on the phone, and it got really stranger because they were also resisting. And in fact, the guy's picture is on page 9 here, because he just died a year ago. But this reporter saw fit to put his picture there in color as a part of her story. So the story is saying that Oswald, according to the Fargo Forum reporters back in 1963, discovered that Oswald was not there. They couldn't find any evidence. So this reporter decided to juxtapose their initial 1963 assassination reportage with my research 60 years later to show that the case isn't closed, that there are researchers that went there in 99 when we went to Stanley, North Dakota, after talking to John Armstrong. So now that was 40 years, now it's 60 years. And she did a great job juxtaposing the two time frames and saying, maybe the Fargo Forum reporters were wrong in 1963 about Oswald never being in North Dakota. And you see what bred this whole thing was. There was a reporter named Alaine Mosby, Mosby. And she was in Moscow when Oswald defected. And the embassy gave her his room number at the Metropole Hotel. This is 1959 when he's defecting, same week, basically. So she goes to the Metropole Hotel to interview him. And she reports that he described being in New York City growing up with his mother, Marguerite, and how they moved in 1954 from New York to North Dakota. That's what caught my attention when I first saw the Dallas Monthly news or article by John Armstrong. And the Fargo Forum reported in 63 that he wasn't there. It was a typo. It was should have been N-O instead of N-D, North Dakota. Should have been New Orleans, N-O. So that was the end of their research. Until I go to Stanley, North Dakota, 40 years later, whatever it is, and find these witnesses who won't talk. I find them in, I found one guy in, I think he was in Portland, Oregon. And I called him up. You know, a lot of people leave North Dakota because of the weather, right?
I would say you got 7 inches of snow out there. Even if it disappears in a day, that's too much for me.
Yeah, so, where was I?
Talking about a lot of people leave North Dakota.
Yeah, so I find these people that were in Stanley, North Dakota in 1954, and I find them, especially. I find William Timmer, who played with Oswald in 1954 in Bullhead City, and I find a friend of his in Portland, Oregon, and I call him, and he says, you know, I've always wondered why the FBI came to Stanley and interviewed me when I was a kid. on December 23rd, 1963. So he says, you know, I was kind of thinking about going to Arizona to meet up with my old friend, William Timmer. And so he goes. And he says he's sitting in a room in Bullhead City with the woman that wrote LBJ the letter, resulting in the FBI going to Stanley, North Dakota. And he says the stepfather, the mother's fourth husband, was sitting there. And I wanted to ask William Timmer about what he thought about the FBI interviewing us way back in December of 63. And he says the stepfather immediately goes like this across his neck and says, "We've talked about this too much already. End of conversation." Well, I did some research on this fourth husband and discovered, well, he worked in the oil fields around Stanley, and ex-Army, been in the Philippines. There was a picture on the wall of him on a horse because he was in the horse cavalry. And his name was associated with intelligence in Washington, D.C. Now, maybe just a coincidence, but the fact that he shut down a childhood friend of the guy that played with Oswald is pretty fishy. Well, then I ended up calling the mother, and she, when I came around to her fourth husband, and she said, "Yeah, my husband worked in Washington." Washington, and then she emphasized Washington State. She didn't want me to think she was saying D.C. And so it made me think that maybe this guy was actually the intel person I found in D.C. Same name, same middle initial even. And she then says, "Well, you know, I've already said too much. I can't talk anymore about this." It was like he was standing over her, coaching her to quit talking. So, you know, when the Fargo Forum said Oswald wasn't in North Dakota back in 63, you know, you can't expect them to have done that kind of research in 63. They were just relieved Oswald wasn't there. But the plot thickens because my next door neighbor, my friend Bruce's father, the state petroleum engineer, guess who he would have to, and I think maybe I didn't talk about this previously. He would have to meet with H.L. Hunt to get, yes, H.L. Hunt. And H.L. Hunt wasn't totally unfamiliar with North Dakota. In fact, he was trying to become a professional poker player back in the 1920s.
That's why he always wore the sunglasses, that son of a gun.
Well, he was working in the wheat fields as a laborer back in the 20s and playing poker at night with everybody, trying to hone his skills. And he got his ass kicked one night by somebody, and the guy told him, "Son, you ain't going to be a poker player. Go back to college." Hunt goes back to Arkansas, Texarkana border, when the spindle top oil strike happens, and Hunt runs with it and becomes a billionaire, right? But Mr. Folsom, my next door neighbor, the state petroleum engineer, said, "There I am meeting with H.L. Hunt in the 50s and early 60s, and he's got to do paperwork so he can drill around Stanley, North Dakota." And I couldn't get him to focus on the paperwork. We'd been at a Holiday Inn in Bismarck, North Dakota, and all he wanted to do is talk about killing Kennedy.
Jeez.
And he, by that time, Hunt was almost blind. And so my next door neighbor, Bert Folsom says, I finally gave up. I left his room and I'm walking down the hallway to go to my room. And I can still hear him ranting about killing Kennedy. He didn't even realize, he was so livid, he didn't even realize I had left the room. Well, Hunt's sons would show up in Grand Forks, late 50s, early 60s, to talk with the petroleum engineers in the UND geology department. It was across the street from where Kennedy gave his speech, September 25th, 63. I mean, they can look out their window and see the arena, which, you know, doesn't necessarily mean anything, but again, context, they were there. And the Hunt brothers are showing up at their office to shoot the shit, maybe on their way west to the oil field, maybe to look at the oil cores. When I was a ninth grader, my buddy and I that went through those doors with no security, his dad got us a job cataloging drill cores from the oil wells in western North Dakota. We'd section them, we'd put them in a box about 5 feet long, and in effect they became a library for future oil companies to figure out where to drill. So I was kind of aware of how the oil industry worked, and there was Hunt, and imagine Hunt being the sugar daddy of the John Birch movement. He's seeing, when he goes to Stanley, all these Finnish communists. Hell, they're openly running for county commissioner and city councilman, et cetera, et cetera. There were that many of them, they felt that safe. So here's Hunt thinking, holy shit, maybe this would be a good place to frame a patsy. So when I told Peter Dale Scott this scenario, he says, well, you know, the people that you interviewed, whether they were still there or had moved to the West Coast, they very well could have been part of a plot where they unwittingly testified to the presence of an Oswald character there in order to frame him. Because they, you know, the right wing was after Kennedy starting in the 50s when he was a senator and so on. So it's not like the Birchers hadn't identified him as a communist already. I mean, that's how crazy they were. JFK was a communist before he even turned down nuking Moscow. And so at this point, Armstrong has me, you know, going to Stanley, North Dakota to do this research. So I call up the University of North Dakota drill core lab. Still there. I'd remembered what I had done as a kid. I said, have you got information about all the oil wells drilled around Stanley, North Dakota? Oh yeah, it's all computerized. Could I have a printout? I get the printout. Just about all the land around Stanley, North Dakota was leased by H.L. Hunt. Somehow, he managed to get the paperwork done, even though he wanted to talk about killing Kennedy all the time. Now, another one of the geologists was also the father of a good friend of mine in the same neighborhood, next to the campus. So I called him up and I said, tell me about what the profile of that geology department looks like. He says they were all to the right of Attila the Hun. I was the only liberal. He says the Hunt brothers would show up. He didn't say why. But between Stanley, North Dakota being this hotbed of Finnish communists 250 miles to the west, and the oil people in Grand Forks, where there were no oil wells, just the records. You know, when I told Peter Dale Scott all this, like he said, maybe these people were unwittingly coached to be a part of the plot. Now, supposedly, the article in the Fargo Forum and other places should have read New Orleans and not North Dakota. So that's been the understanding for 60 years, that it was a typo. Elaine Mosby, who interviewed Oswald in Moscow in his hotel room, even said to the Fargo Forum in 63, geez, I'm sorry it got misprinted as North Dakota instead of New Orleans, because he said New Orleans. But John Newman's book, JFK in Vietnam, I think it is, he has detailed timeframes of Oswald's defection. And he describes how Mosby is in the hotel room with Oswald, and she wants to get the interview so she can have it on the desk of the FBI and the UPI, I believe, news service by Monday morning. She's talking to Oswald on Saturday, I think. Well, that the person who is actually in charge of the investigation of the assassination for the FBI was Alan Belmont.
Belmont Helicopters?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, that'd be even crazier. I'm like, damn.
Yeah, right. So Alan Belmont, he's controlling where the investigation is going to go. And they concoct a report about Oswald, you know, real quickly. Case closed. Oswald was the assassin, et cetera, et cetera. But that memo that Elaine Mosby wrote and said ND instead of NO, it's on his desk Monday morning. And even though she said, I'm sorry, it was a misprint, should have been NO, not ND, he said at New Orleans. The bigger context is Stanley, North Dakota is, as far as the Birchers are concerned, a hotbed of communism. Alan Belmont has to know. He's the one that sends the FBI on December 23rd to Stanley, North Dakota to investigate the letter to LBJ. Ostensibly, he realized if he left it at ND instead of NO, it made it possible to frame a patsy called Lee Harvey Oswald. Associate him with communists so that, now this is 1959 when he gets the story in the memo on his desk Monday morning. And he's running the investigation. So, you know, I think that that's very likely what happened in terms of how they cooked the evidence. And it wouldn't mean shit to a tree, as Dylan said, if none of this other context and circumstantial evidence didn't exist. Whether it be the county attorney saying, I know nothing. The woman that wrote the letter to LBJ saying, I've said too much already. You know, trying to protect her fourth husband who was in that oil field in 1954. And of course, the critics will say, well, why would they be concocting a story about Oswald in North Dakota in 1954? Well, we turned up another witness that couple of days we were in Stanley, who also hung out with Oswald in 1956, 2 years later. Now, it didn't make sense. And now, how would Oswald and Marguerite get to Stanley, North Dakota in 1954? I mean, it's not like there were freeways. We didn't have jet travel the same way we do now. Well, guess what? You can get on a train at Grand Central in New York, go all the way to Chicago, change trains to the Great Northern Empire Builder, which goes all the way to Seattle, but it stops in Stanley, North Dakota, among 50 other stops along the way, including Grand Forks, where I would watch it stop, where I'd sometimes take the train to the West Coast. So there was a way to get there. Now, I talked to a I was in New York for some history conference, and I had called, I can't remember his name now, but he ran the lingerie shop in Manhattan, in a section of Manhattan called Yorkville. A lot of immigrants from Eastern Europe there. And I called up the guy that ran the lingerie shop because John Armstrong had found out about him because Marguerite was working there. So I thought, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well take the subway up to the Upper East Side. And he told me that, yeah, Marguerite worked here. And one day she announces she's leaving town. And I don't think he said that she was going to Stanley, North Dakota. But the point is, she had worked there. He knew her attitudes and behavior. The best lingerie shop I've ever walked through. I mean, top of the line stuff. Should have bought something for my wife. Didn't have enough stage presence to pull that off. So anyway, that was that, you know. So I'm trying to track where they were, where they went to, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think you've interviewed a professor here from the University of Minnesota, James Norwood.
No.
He's brilliant. He taught a semester-long course at the University of Minnesota for years until he retired.
About the Kennedy stuff?
Yeah, five, six years ago.
Toss him my email.
Yeah, I will. He did the video or the podcast, whatever you want to call it, with DPUK a year or so ago.
Well, they got to stop taking guests from me, so.
Yeah. I'll tell him that. So anyway.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, we talk about this a lot, and he claims that I spurred him to not just read books, but to go and interview people firsthand, face to face. And so last year he went to Fort Worth, and he did this brilliant research piece on Marguerite's house locations in Fort Worth, mainly in Fort Worth. And he was able to flesh out the sequences of addresses. And he contends that, and he's a fan of John Armstrong, so that's part of his motivation. And he discovers that she moves so frequently to like four or five different places. But how do you do that when you don't have any money? So he believes the CIA, the FBI was making any paper trail so confusing for anybody to find or make sense out of her movements. But yeah, I think the article is printed at Di Eugenio's site.
Oh, Kennedy's and King.
Yeah, you'd find it there. Anyway, you know, there's thousands of data points, I guess you call them, that can be mined and have been mined to make sense out of all this. And you know, yeah, I've been fortunate to be in New York and Dallas and New Orleans, where my son lived for 10 years, and to make a point. I mean, I could have just said to hell with it, it's too hard, but every time I was in a place, I did some research. And I don't know, I'm just convinced that it all hangs together, or a high enough percentage of it, so that we kind of, we more than kind of know what's going on or what went on. Now, how long have we been doing this?
I was about to say, yeah, I got a final question for you and we can wrap it. You've given me enough of your time, Gary, but I was going to ask, what would you recommend or what would you give advice wise towards anybody who's a new generation researcher or someone who wants to look into the assassination and knowing that it's still going on for 60 something years? Under the Cover of Night, is that your new book?
No, it's Sean Fetter. Have you heard about it? 2 volumes, $45 a piece. I'm not ready to get the second one.
Jesus.
But I couldn't put it down. Hardcover. He was
looks
some
heavy.
Sort of, he denies that David Lifton was his employer as a research assistant. I mean, he was, but he rips Lifton's research in this book. And I'd spent 2 hours on the phone with him a couple months ago before I ordered the book. And I must say, the guy is brilliant. He's a ex-news reporter, TV person. I'd never heard of him. But there was a post with a phone number in it by the publisher. And so I called him, and for 2 hours, he spent convincing me that he had solved the case. And after reading the first volume, I don't know what D. Eugenio is going to say about it, because Doug Horn ripped it, at least the medical evidence part of it. And so that's the only interview or review I could find. But what he does is modify greatly Lifton's coffin possession scenario. But he interviews 50 Air Force people that were never interviewed, who were involved in the movement of Kennedy's body from Dallas to Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda. And he discovers what Lifton basically screwed up and left tangents undeveloped. And because he went out of his way to find about 50 Air Force people who were there, he claims he's proved that there were 2 coffins.
There's 3.
Yeah, 3. He talks about 3. He talks about 2 deaths in Dealey Plaza, Kennedy and somebody else. The somebody else, I think, is going to end up being in volume 2.
Somebody else that died in Dealey Plaza. There's a person that had like a aneurysm or something or seizure. And then there was the Mr. X, which is the guy came in all bloody into Parkland Hospital.
Yeah, and I think that's who he's alluding to.
That's interesting, because that was Wilma Tice's testimony in Parkland Hospital. She stated, what's it, Wilma Tice? Might have been somebody starts with a B. Might be, it's been a while since I looked at the clip, but there was a blood pool in Dealey Plaza by the podium, where a little bit behind where Abraham Zapruder stood. They chalked it up to a red snow cone, though.
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting.
He does. I mean, I couldn't put it down. And people accuse him of being arrogant and a braggart. And that is on every page. In effect, saying, I have solved the case because of my superior intelligence and investigative skills.
Well, he's a little late because Rob Reiner solved it on his podcast. So.
Right. So before we go, just let me say what I was going to say about Gary Schoner. So, Rob Clark?
Yeah.
A lone gunman.
Good guy.
Yeah, he calls me a couple months ago and says,
yeah, I gave him your contact info.
Yeah. Yeah, so he asked me if I'd help Gary Schoner find the film of Oswald on Canal Street passing out literature. And on the same film is this person named John T. Martin in the Twin Cities who is the guy who was a 17-year-old made this film in Dallas and New Orleans. And Schoner, I think, you know, he obviously talked about it, not this particular film, but when you interviewed him, he talked about experiences in New Orleans and so on. And there was a talk show that went on for 10 hours on a local community radio station in Minneapolis in 1967, I think it was. And people kept calling in. And because it wasn't a commercial station, they could just stay on the air. And the 17-year-old calls him up, John T. Martin, and says, I have a piece of film that you can have. So Rob Clark says, Schoner can't find the film. Well, it's 57 years ago. And so I've been talking to Schoner about the chances of him finding this film. And so no luck yet, but I think I'm on the trail of the guy that took it, lives about 10 miles from me. And anyway, Schoner and the big researcher from Frederick, Maryland, who was in town in 67 to give a lecture at the University of Minnesota on the assassination. Oh, what's his name? Anyway, they're doing the radio show together when the guy calls in and says, you can have my film, let's meet. So Schoner meets with him someplace in St. Paul. He can't remember where, of course, but the film is clear. Subsequently, the film was given to the FBI, the Sixth Floor Museum. Now, he gave it to Schoner when he was 17. Well, maybe he's 21. At any rate, the film was doctored by the FBI, because when this John T. Martin got his film back, pieces had been taken out. It was darkened. Schoner's version is bright. You can see everything. So the story is that John T. Martin, as a 17-year-old, went to Dallas and then on to New Orleans. Now, this kid was at 17, a card-carrying member of the John Birch Society and the Minutemen. And his hero was General Walker. Now, Rob Clark is saying, we think that he went there as a family trip. 17 years old, you'd think that would be the case, but whatever. He gets into Walker's house and films the bullet hole in the ceiling or the window frame. And then on the same piece of film, he goes on to New Orleans and he films Oswald passing out literature on Canal. So this is what Schoner is trying to find. Because obviously Walker could be part of the larger plot, the instigator, the shaker and mover, let's say. And it's pretty amazing that now, somebody that Rob Clark works with had tracked this John T. Martin to the Twin Cities. And I've heard about a John T. Martin for 30 years. And until this happened, I had no sense of which way to go. I think I did contact relatives, now that I think of it, in a suburb, northeast suburb of St. Paul, about 7, 8 years ago. But I... just like Rob Clark says, we call all these numbers and we can't get anybody to answer the phone. So I've got to go there and see what I can come up with. And when he gave the film, when this John T. Clark gave the film to the Sixth Form Museum, he told them, "You can never tell anybody that I gave you this film." And so this guy that works with Rob Clark did an apparently amazing amount of digging to find him in the Twin Cities, right down to the high school he went to in the yearbook. And so they're 99% sure that he's the one that took the film. He may be a snowbird and isn't back in town yet, but you know, he, in effect, he was cooperating back in 67 by giving the film to Schoner, saying this is important stuff about how the assassination happened. He just didn't want anybody to know who he was. Yet he called in the radio program. Whether he said his name there on the air, I don't know. But he lives in, if I've got it right, he lives in a very expensive lakeshore property 10 miles from me. I pass within a half a mile of it many times a week going to my grandkids' place. So stuff just keeps coming out of the woodwork.
Well, Gary, you've given me enough of your time. Is there a place where people can find your links?
Yeah, like I've said before, it's pretty much just doing Google searches, Severson Oswald. My blog that I don't post much on very frequently, but it has interviews with Dennis David and Madeline Brown, very extensive interviews that have been transcribed. And the blog is called Three Shots at Life, which is about the research I did in Life magazine's involvement in the cover-up. I don't know if I think I talked about that.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it, Robbie.
Oh, thank you for joining me again, man. Always, you got a lot of stories. I'm sure we've barely tapped the well of them so far. But I'll make sure I link all your links in the description, Gary. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again, my friend. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for next episode.